Chapter 16. The Unknown Deep. My slumber was so profound and dreamless that I have no idea how long it lasted. But when finally I awoke, it was with a sense of the most vivid and appalling terror. Every nerve in my body seemed paralyzed. I could not move or cry out. Invisible bands, stronger than iron, held me on my bed a prisoner, and I could only stare upwards in horror, like a victim bound to the rack, staring at the pitiless faces of his torturers. A figure, tall, massive, and clothed all in black, stood beside me. I could not see its face, but I felt its eyes gazing down upon me with a remorseless, cold inquiry, silent, searching, and answering itself without words. If every thought in my brain and every emotion of my soul could have been cut out of me with a dissecting knife and laid bare to disinterested inspection, those terrible eyes, probing deeply into the innermost recesses of my being, would have done the work. The beating of my heart was loud and insistent in my own ears. I lay still, trying to gain control over my trembling spirit. It was almost with an awful sense of relief that I saw the figure move at last from its rigid attitude and beckon to me, slowly and commandingly, with one outstretched arm from which the black, dank draperies hung like a drifting cloud. Mechanically obeying the signal, I strove to rise from my bed and found I could do so. I sat up shiveringly and looked at the terrifying form that towered above me, enclosing me in its shadow. Then, managing to stand, though unsteadily, on my feet, I mutely prepared to follow where it should lead. The shadow moved on, and I moved after it, compelled by some overpowering instinct which I dared not resist. For an instant the vague, half-formed thought flitted through my brain, "This is death which summons me away." And then with that thought came the remembrance that, according to the schooling I was receiving, there is no such thing as death. There is only the phantom we call by that name. Slowly, sedately, and with indescribable majesty of movement, the dark figure glided on before me, and I, a trembling little creature, followed it, knowing not whither. There was no obstacle in our course. Doors, walls, and windows seemed as we passed to become nothing, and there was no stop to our onward progress until suddenly I saw before me a steep and narrow spiral stairway of stone, winding upward to the very peak of a rocky pinnacle. This, in turn, lifted its topmost heights into the darkness of a night sky, sprinkled with millions of stars. Somber figure paused, and again I felt the searchlight of its invisible eyes burning into me. After a while, as though satisfied with its brief survey, the figure began again slowly to ascend the spiral stair. I followed it, step by step. The way was long and difficult. The sharp turns dizzied my senses, and there seemed to be no end to the upward winding. Sometimes I stumbled and nearly fell. Sometimes I groped my way on hands and knees, seeing always before me the black-draped form that moved on with apparent indifference to whether, in my obedience to its summons, I fared well or badly. And now, as I climbed, all sorts of strange memories began to creep into the crannies of my brain, perplexing me with trouble and uncertainty. Chiefly my mind dwelt on cruelties, the cruelties practiced by human beings on one another, moral cruelties especially, which are so much worse than physical torture. I thought of the world's wicked misjudgments passed on those nobler in spirit than the judges themselves, of how, even when people endeavor to do good to others, their kindest deeds are often represented to the world as nothing but self-interest and self-seeking, of how people's supposedly best friends often wrong them and listen believingly to false tales invented against them, of how even in love, love, that most ethereal, yet most powerful of passions, a rough word, an unmerited slight, may separate for lifetimes those whose love would otherwise have been perfect. And still I climbed, and still I thought, and still the dark phantom figure ahead beckoned me on and on. And then I began to consider that, in climbing in deep darkness to some unknown and unseen height, I might, after all, be doing a wiser thing than living in the world with the ways of men, ways that are, for the most part, hypocritical, ways practiced merely to triumph over one's fellow beings, ways of fashionable society, ways of government forever ephemeral, while nature, invincible and eternal, moves on her appointed course with changeless intuition to destroy evil and preserve the good. And man, the agent of evil, fools himself into believing that his evil shall prosper and his falsehood be accepted as truth, if he can but make a sufficient show of religious faith and faithfulness to social values to deceive himself and perhaps a few others. What is sin? It is only error in understanding the law which governs all things. So I mused as I climbed ever upward, keeping my eyes fixed on the figure leading me on. Now I reached the end of the spiral stair and was slowly mounting to the highest peak of the rocky pinnacle that lifted itself to the heavens. An icy wind began to blow. My feet were bare, and I was clad only in my thin nightclothes, with the slight addition of a white woolen wrap that, when I left my bed to follow the spectral leader, I had flung around me hastily for warmth. I shivered, frozen through and through by the bitter cold. Yet I went resolutely on. Indeed, having started on this perilous adventure, there was no returning, for when I looked back the way I had come, the spiral stairway had vanished completely, and nothing remained but black and empty space. This last discovery so terrified me that for a moment I lost my breath and came to a halt in the very act of ascending. Then I saw the figure in front of me turn about with a threatening motion, and I felt that with one second more of hesitation, I should lose my footing altogether and slip to an abysmal depth of unimaginable doom. Making a strong effort, I regained my escaping self-control and forced my shuddering limbs to obey my will and resume their work. Thus, slowly, inch by inch, I resumed my climb, sick with giddiness and fear, and chilled to the very bone. Presently, I heard a rumbling roar, like the sound of great billows rushing into hollow caverns, which echoed back with thuds of booming thunder. Looking up, I saw the figure I had followed stand still, and I fancied that the somber draperies in which it was enveloped showed the outline of a glimmering of light. Fired by sudden hope, I set myself to treading anew this difficult path. Presently I, too, stood without movement beside my mysterious leader. Above me was a heaven of stars. Below me, an unfathomable deep of darkness where nothing was visible. From this nothingness, however, rose a mighty turbulence as of an angry sea. I remained where I was, afraid to move. One false step and I might, so it seemed, be hurled down to a destruction that, though it could not mean death, would almost certainly plunge me into chaos. I felt almost inclined to catch at the cloudy garments of the solemn figure at my side, pleading for safety and protection. And while this desire was yet upon me, the figure turned its veiled head toward me and spoke in a low, deep tone that I found infinitely gentle. "So far," it said, "and yet not far enough." It gazed at me penetratingly. "To what end," it said, "wilt thou venture for love's sake?" "To no end whatsoever," I answered with sudden boldness, "no end, but to everlasting continuance." Again, within those somber draperies, I thought I saw a faintly glowing light. "What wouldst thou do for love?" the voice again inquired. "Wouldst thou bear all trials and believe all good things? Canst thou hear falsehood and contradiction of what you know to be the truth, and yet still love? Wilt thou endure all suffering, all misunderstanding, all coldness and cruelty, and yet keep thy soul bright as a burning lamp, with the flame of faith and constancy? Wouldst thou scale the heavens and plunge to the uttermost hells for the sake of love?" I looked up at the figure and strove in vain to see its face. "All these things I would do," I answered. "All that is in my power to endure, mortally and immortally, I would bear for love's sake." Again the light flashed through those black garments. When the figure next spoke, its voice rang out harshly in ominous warning. "Thou hast no chance in this life of finding perfect love," it proclaimed. "Dost thou believe this?" A cold agony gripped my breast. I refused to yield to it, but answered resolutely, "No, I do not believe it. God could not be indifferent to me, even if he made me wait for incarnations, even if he did not reveal himself to me for eons. His love will be with me forever." There was a pause, during which only the thunder of the invisible sea far below us was audible. Then the voice went on, "In God's eyes, people are no more than crawling ants. He cares not a whit for thy suffering. Dost thou believe this?" I took no time for thought, but answered at once without hesitation, "No. For Jesus said not a swallow falls without his sight. Those are the words of spirit, and spirit cannot lie." Another pause. Then the voice put me a third question. "Dost thou truly believe in God, thy creator, the maker of heaven and earth?" Lifting my eyes to the starry deep sky above me, half in hope, half in appeal, I replied fervently, "I do believe in him with all my soul." A silence followed, which seemed long and weighted with suspense. Then the voice spoke once more, "Dost thou believe in love, the generator of life, and the moving cause and mind of all things created? And again I replied, I do believe with all my soul. The figure now bent slightly towards me, and the light within its darkness became more lambent and more brilliant. Presently an arm and a hand, white and radiant, shaped as of living flame, outstretched slowly from the enfolding draperies. It pointed steadily to the abyss below. If thy love is so great, said the voice, if thy faith is so strong, if thy trust in God is sure and perfect, plunge thither. I heard, but could not credit my hearing. I gazed at the shrouded and veiled speaker, at the commanding arm that was consigning my mortal body to destruction. For a moment I was lost in a wild terror and a wilder doubt. Was this fearful suggestion a temptation or a test? Should it be obeyed? I strove to find the calm center of my being, to gather all my forces together, to make myself sure of my own will, that I be responsible for my own deeds. And then I paused. All that was purely mortal in me shuddered, as if on the brink of the unknown. One look upward to the soft gloom of the purple sky and its myriad stars. One horrified glance downward at the dark depth where I heard the roaring of the sea. I clasped my hands in a kind of prayerful desperation, looked once more at the solemn shadow beside me. If thy love is so great, it repeated in slow and impressive tones, if thy faith is so strong, if thy trust in God is so sure and perfect. There came a moment of tense stillness, a moment in which my life seemed detached from myself, so that I held it like a palpitating creature in the palms of my hands. Suddenly, the recollection of that last vision came to me. The vision of all those I had seen among the dark mountains of Koryusk came back to me vividly. That of the woman who had drowned in the churning seas, consigning her soul to God. A sob broke uncalled for from my lips. My eyes filled with burning tears, blinding me. Imploringly, I turned once more toward the relentless figure beside me. Its hand still pointed downwards, and again I heard the words, if thy love is so great, if thy faith is so strong, if thy trust in God is so sure and perfect. And then, suddenly, I found my own center, the very core of my being. Then, standing firmly upon the plane of imperishable force, I came to a quick resolution. Nothing can destroy me, I said inwardly. Nothing can slay the immortal part of me, and nothing can separate my soul from the divine. In all earth and all heaven, there is no cause for fear. Hesitating no longer, I closed my eyes. Then, extending my hands, I threw myself forward and plunged into the darkness. Down, down, interminably down. A light, like a meteoric shaft of luminance, followed me, piercing the blackness. I retained sufficient consciousness to wonder at its brilliancy, and for a time I was borne along in my descent as though on wings, down, ever down. I saw the ocean at my feet, a heaving mass of angry waters, flecked with a wool-like fleece of foam. The change that is called death, but that is truly life. This was the only clear thought that flashed like lightning through my brain as I sank swiftly towards the engulfing sea. Then everything swirled into darkness and silence. A delicate, warm glow, like the filtering of sunbeams through shaded silk and crystal. A fragrance of roses. A delicious sound of harp-like music. To these things I was gradually awakened by a gentle pressure on my brows. I looked up, and my whole heart relieved itself in a long, deep sigh of ecstasy. It was Aselzion himself who bent over me, Aselzion whose grave blue eyes watched me with earnest and anxious solicitude. I smiled up at him in response to his wordless questioning as to how I felt, and I would have risen had he not signed to me imperatively to lie still. "Rest," he said, and his voice was very low and tender. "Rest, dear child, you have done more than well." Another sigh of pure happiness escaped me. I stretched out my arms lazily, like one aroused from a long and refreshing sleep. My sensations were now perfectly exquisite. A fresh and radiant life seemed to be coursing through my veins, and I was content to remain a perfectly passive recipient of this inflow of health and joy. The room in which I found myself was new to me. It seemed made up of lovely colorings and of a profusion of sweet flowers. I lay as if enshrined in a little temple of beauty. I had no desire to move or to speak. Every trouble, every hardship had passed from my mind. I watched Aselzion dreamily as he brought a chair beside my couch and sat down. Then, taking my hand in his, he felt my pulse with close attention. I smiled again. "Does it still beat?" I asked, finding my voice suddenly. "Surely the great sea has drowned it." Still holding my hand, he looked full into my eyes. "Many waters cannot quench love," he quoted softly. "Dear child, you have proved that truth. Be satisfied." Raising myself on my pillows, I studied his grave face with an earnest scrutiny. "Tell me," I half whispered, "have I failed?" He pressed my hand encouragingly. "No, you have almost won the battle." "Almost, only almost?" I sank back again on the couch, wondering and waiting. He remained silently beside me. After a little while, the suspense became unbearable. I spoke again. "How did I escape?" I asked. "Who saved me when I fell?" He smiled gravely. "There was nothing from which to escape," he answered. "And no one saved you, since you were not in danger." "Not in danger?" I echoed, amazed. "No, the only danger you faced was from yourself." I gazed at him in utter bewilderment. He gave me a kind and reassuring look. "Have patience," he said gently. "All shall be explained to you in good time. Meanwhile, this apartment is yours for the rest of your stay here, which I do not anticipate will be long. I have had all of your things removed from the probation room in the tower. You will be troubled no more by its scenic transformations." Here he smiled again. "I will leave you now to recover from the terrors through which you have so bravely passed. Rest and refresh yourself thoroughly, for you have nothing now to fear. When you are quite ready, touch this," and he pointed to a bell. "I shall hear its summons and will come to you at once. Before I could say a word to detain him, he had retired, and I was left alone. I rose from my couch. The first impression I had was that of a singular ease and lightness, a sense of physical strength and well-being that was delightful beyond expression. The loveliness and peace of the room in which I lay enchanted me. Everything upon which my eyes rested suggested beauty. The windows were shaded with rose silk hangings, and when I drew these aside, I looked out on a marble balcony overhung with climbing roses. This balcony, in its turn, opened onto an exquisite glimpse of garden and blue sea. There was no clock anywhere to tell me the time of day, but the sun was shining, and I imagined that it must be afternoon. Adjoining this luxurious apartment was an equally luxurious bathroom, furnished with every conceivable elegance. The bath itself was of marble, and the water bubbled up from its center like a natural spring, sparkling as it came. I found all my clothes, books, and other belongings arranged with care where I could reach them most easily. To my joy, the book, The Secret of Life, lay on a small table by itself, like a treasure set apart. I bathed and dressed quickly, allowing myself no time to think about any strange or perplexing point in my adventures, but giving myself up entirely to the joy of the new and ecstatic life that thrilled through me. A mirror in the room showed me my face, happy and radiant. My own eyes were bright and smiling. No care had left any slightest trace on my features, and I was fully conscious of a perfect strength and health that made the simple act of breathing a divine pleasure. In a very short time, I was ready to receive Aselzion and touch the bell he had indicated as a signal. I then sat down by the window and looked out on the fair prospect before me. How glorious, I thought, is this world! How full of beauty! That heavenly blue of sky and sea melting into one, the tender hues of the clambering roses against the green of the surrounding foliage, the lovely light that filtered down through the air like powdered gold. Were not all these things for which to be thankful? And can there be any real unhappiness as long as our souls are in tune with the complete harmony of creation? Hearing a step behind me, I rose, and with a glad smile stretched out my hands to Aselzion, who had just then entered. He took them in his own and pressed them lightly. Then, drawing a chair opposite to mine, he sat down. His face expressed a certain gravity, and his voice, when he began to speak, was low and gentle. "I have much to tell you," he said, "but I will be as brief as I can. You came here to pass a certain psychic ordeal, and you have passed it successfully, all but just the last phase. Of that we will speak presently. For the moment you are under the impression that you have been through certain episodes of a more or less perplexing and terrifying nature. So you have, but not in the way you think. Nothing whatever has happened to you, save in your own mind. Your adventures have been purely mental, and were the result of several brains working on yours, and compelling you to see and to hear what they chose. There, do not look so startled." For I had risen with an involuntary exclamation. "I will explain everything to you quite clearly, and soon you will understand." He paused. I sat down again by the window, wondering and waiting. "In this world," he went on slowly, "it is not climate or one's natural surroundings that affect man, so much as the influences brought to bear on him by his fellow men. Human beings live surrounded by the waves of thought that are flung off by their own brains and by the brains of those around them. That is the reason why, if they are not strong enough to find their own inner center, they are influenced by moods and ways of thinking that would never be their own by choice and free will. If a mind, or let's say a soul, can resist the impressions brought to bear upon it by other forces than itself, if it can stand alone, free of obstacles, in the light of the divine image, then it has gained a mastership over all things. But the attainment of such a position is so difficult as to be generally impossible. Influences work around us everywhere. Men and women with great aims in life are discouraged from their intentions by the indifference or the mockery of friends. Brave deeds are hindered from accomplishment by the suggestion of difficulties that do not really exist. And the daily scattering and waste of psychic force by disturbing or opposing brainwaves is sufficient to make the world a perfect hell, where it might otherwise be a perfect paradise. He waited a moment, bent his eyes earnestly upon me as he resumed. You need not be told by me that you have lived many lives on this earth, and that you have many times been drawn into connection with the other half of yourself, that half which, both of you, blindly seeking each other, you have often rejected when found. It was not often of yourselves that this rejection occurred. It was not so much you who rejected it, but simply the influences around you to which you yielded. Now, in this further phase of your existence, you have been given another chance. It is quite possible that, had you not come to me, you would have lost the connection again. It was this knowledge which made me receive you against all the rules of our order, seeing that you were fairly resolved. Your ordeal would have been longer had you not made that first bold advance yourself on the occasion of your entrance into our chapel. The light of the cross and the star drew you, and your soul obeyed the attraction. Had you opposed its intention with doubts and fears, I should have had more trouble with you, and might even have feared to undertake what has been, for me also, a difficult job. But you took that first step yourself, and with rare courage. The rest, for me, and also for you, was comparatively easy. He paused again, then continued. I have already said that you are under the impression of having gone through certain adventures or episodes that have tended to distress and perplex you. These things have had no existence except in your own thoughts. When I took you up to your turret room, I placed you under my influence and under that of four other people acting in conjunction with me. We took possession of your mind and made it, as far as possible, a blank slate on which we wrote as we chose. The test was to see whether your soul, which is the real you, could withstand and overcome our negative suggestions. At first this may sound as though for our entertainment we played a trick on you. It was not so. We merely applied one of the most powerful lessons everyone needs to learn in life, namely, to rise above the resistance and conquest of others' influences. For these impressions, which we receive constantly in the world, are the disturbing and weakening forces with which all of us have to contend. I began to see clearly what he meant me to understand, and hung upon his words with eager attention. You have only to look about you, he continued, to realize the truth of what I say. Every day you meet someone whose power of accomplishment might have been great, had it not been for the restricting or discouraging influences to which it allowed itself to succumb. How often have you not come upon a man or a woman of brilliant abilities who was rendered incompetent by the influences of a wife, a husband, parents, or acquaintances, and who therefore live the life virtually of a bird in a cage? Take the thousands of men wrongly mated, whose wives or children have dragged them down, killing within them every spark of ambition and accomplishment. Take the thousands of women persuaded or forced into union with men whose coarse taste degraded them to a level from which it was almost impossible to rise. Such is the curse of influences, the magnetic currents from other brains that set our own thinking awry. They cause half the trouble and mischief in the world. Think how often parents, through attachment or degraded personal habits, have prevented their offspring from soaring to their true potential. Not one soul in 100,000 has the force or the courage to resist these and countless other influences around them. Love, the miraculous touchstone that converts everything to gold, is driven out of the heart, with the result that life itself grows weary of its present phase and makes haste to seek another one that might be more congenial. Enthusiasm for an ideal, a search for truth, for example, or the pursuit of an artistic career, is often nipped in the bud by the demand others make upon one that he take up a lucrative career. Hence, people often die prematurely, and they continue that way for lifetime after lifetime. I was about to interrupt him with an eager question, but he silenced me by a gesture. "Your position," he went on, "from a psychic point of view, which is the only valid, because the only lasting one, is that of having found the other half of your spiritual and immortal ego. This means you can now attain the perfection in everything you seek and in life itself. Because this is so great a gift and so entirely divine, influences are bound to try to oppose you, to separate you, to confuse the harmony of your relationship, and to come between you. If they don't do that, they will try to belittle your relationship or try to make it seem what it is not, a merely human attachment, belittling its sacredness. In order to preserve the sanctity of your relationship, it is important for you to protect it from lower influences. Your union is solely for the purpose of merging together in God. Therefore, you must both maintain always a certain distance between you. God, not human affection, is the goal. Therefore, the bond between you is not only a blessing, it is also a test of your faithfulness to the highest ideal. This test needs to be worked out between you, and I think you have done so already in past lives. But your relationship to the world is there in countless departments of your life, and your relationship above all to God is your highest goal. Is there anything in this world that still attracts you? Is there any self-seeking in your search for God? These important issues can be decided only by yourself. All these require clarification. But when you meet your soulmate and are able to feel a harmonious relationship with him or her, you feel completed as a human being. We have tried to help you resolve these issues. Therefore, when I and the other brains acting with me placed you under our power, we impressed you with all that most readily shakes the human, and especially the feminine mind. Doubt, jealousy, suspicion, and all the wretched terrors these emotions engender. You heard, or rather thought you heard, voices behind a wall. There were no voices. There was only a suggestion of voices in your own mind. You saw strange shadows and phantoms. They had no existence, except insofar as we made them seem so, by presenting them to your mental vision. You wandered away into unknown places, so you imagined. As a matter of fact, you never left your room. Never left my room? Oh, that cannot be. It can be, because it is, he answered me with a grave smile. The only thing in your experience that was real was the finding of the book, The Secret of Life, in the purple drape shrine. Here it is. And he took up a copy of the book from the table on which it lay. If you had turned it over a little more, you would have found this. And he read aloud. All action is the material result of thought. Suffering is the result of thinking into pain. Disease is the result of thinking into weakness. Every emotion is the result of right or wrong thinking, with one exception, love. Selfless love is not an emotion, but a principle. As the generator of life, love pervades all things and is in all things. Thought, working within this principle, creates things of beauty and perfection. Thought, working outside this principle, creates misunderstanding and ruin. There is no other secret of life. He pronounced those last words with gentle and impressive emphasis. Then he put the book down and continued speaking. We, for four of my brethren were deeply interested in you, on account of the courage you had shown. We, then, took you up to the utmost height of terror, and to our great joy, found your soul strong enough to conquer the ultimate suggestion of death itself. You held firmly to the truth that there is no death, and with that spiritual certainty, risked all for love. Now we have released you from our spells. His eyes were full of kindness as he looked at me. I want to know if you thoroughly realize the importance of the lesson we have taught. I met his inquiring glance fully and steadily. I think I do, I said. You mean that I must stand alone? Alone, yet not alone, he answered, and his fine face, with its intense feeling and power, became transfigured into light. Alone with love, which is to say alone with God, and therefore surrounded by all that is godlike, lasting, and revivifying. You will return from this place to the conventional world, and you will meet a million influences that will seek to turn you from your chosen way. Opinion, criticism, ridicule, calumny, and downright misunderstanding. All these will come against you like armed foes, bristling with weapons of offense. If you tell them of your quest of life and love, and of what you have experienced here, they will heap you with mockery and derision. If you were to breathe a word of the love that exists between you and Rafael Santoris, 1,000 efforts would be made to separate you from him and to snatch away the happiness you have found in him. How will you endure these trials? What will be your protection? I thought a moment. The same that I have done my best to practice here, I replied. I shall believe nothing of ill report, but listen only to kindness. He bent his eyes upon me searchingly. Remember the force there is in public opinion. The fiercest gale that ever blew down strong trees and made havoc of men's lives and dwellings is hardly a whisper compared to the fury of human minds when they set themselves to destroy a heaven-aspiring soul. Think of the petty grudge felt by the loveless against love, of the spite felt by the restless and unhappy for those who have won peace. All this you will have to bear, for the world is envious, and friendship itself can break down when desires are thwarted or rendered jealous by a greater power. He paused a moment, then looked at me suddenly with great seriousness. It was evident to me that he was about to introduce a wholly new subject. I've been considering a solution, he said, to the problem of having to live among disharmonious people. For even if you are strong inwardly, the opposition and lack of sympathy and understanding from others cannot but be a burden and make it more difficult for you to rise. If you were to create a community, a place where people of like mind could live together in harmony and cooperation, it would solve countless problems. You have had to develop strength within yourself, but it would be better if you could now apply that strength to bringing a group of people into harmony, rather than use it only to fend off negativity and people's lack of interest in your aspirations. You and Santorus together could form such a community of spiritual seekers. It would be a beacon of light, of inspiration, to all mankind. I think that is a wonderful idea, I exclaimed eagerly. It gives me the greatest possible hope for the future. But now, I said, changing the subject, you said my ordeal is not yet over. It will be over tonight, he answered, and I have every expectation that you will pass it unflinchingly. Let us for a moment, he continued, talk of what the world calls miraculous. I believe you are just now conscious of perfect health and of joy in the mere fact of living. Is that not so? Smiling, I bent my head in acquiescence. Understand, then, he continued, that as long as you control the life force of your body, this perfect health will continue. As long as you control the direction of your thoughts, this joy will continue. Everything in nature will serve you to these ends. You have but to ask your servants, and they will obey. Ask of the sun its wisdom, and it will give you wisdom. Ask of the moon its sensitive intuition, and it will give you ever deeper awareness and love. Ask of the storm its power, and it will give you power. Ask of the rose its sweet fragrance, and the very essence of fragrance shall steal into your veins. There is nothing you seek that you will not find. Try your own powers now. And with that, he got up and opened the window a little wider, then signed to me to step out onto the balcony. Here are roses climbing upward on their appointed way. Bend them to you by a single effort of your will. I gazed at him in complete surprise and bewilderment. His answering looks were imperative. By a single effort of your will, he repeated. I obeyed him, raising my eyes to the roses where they clambered upward around the balcony. I inwardly commanded a few of them to turn toward me. The effect was instantaneous. As though blown by a light breeze, they bent down with their bright blossoms. Some of them actually touched my hands, as if caressing them.
That would be called a miracle by the ignorant, said Aselzion. Yet it is nothing more than the physical force of the magnetism within you, which, being focused in a single effort, drew the roses down pliantly to your will. No more miracle is there in this than in the common magnet, which has been trying vainly to teach us lessons about ourselves these many years. Now, relax your will.
Again I obeyed, and the roses moved gently away and back to their former height.
This is an object lesson, said Aselzion, smiling. You must understand that you are now in a position to draw everything to you as easily as you drew those roses. You can draw the germs of health and life to commingle with your blood. On the other hand, you can as easily draw the germs of disease and disintegration. The direction of your will is with you. From the sun, you can draw fresh fuel for your brain and nerves. From the air, sustenance. From beautiful things everywhere, beauty. Nothing will be able to resist the energy you radiate, now that you have learned how to direct it. In everything you do, your acts must be focused on a given point. They must not be disturbed or scattered. The more often you use your will, the more powerful it will become, and the more all-conquering. Never forget, however, that for the will to be used rightly, it must work within the creative principle of love, not outside it. Otherwise, your spiritual strength may bring suffering to others. I sat absorbed and half afraid.
And tonight, I said softly.
He rose from his chair and stood looking down upon me with a certain mixture of kindness and concern.
Tonight, he replied, we shall send for you. You will confront the brethren as one who has passed the same mental tests they are undergoing, and you will face the last fear. I do not think you will fail. I hope not. And I strongly desire that you will keep up your courage to the end.
I ventured to touch his hand.
And afterwards? I queried.
He smiled. Afterwards, life and all its secrets will be with you, and the gift of love.